listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
What is an artist? Author and sociologist of art, Sarah Thornton, circled the world, speaking to artists on four continents to find an answer to this question. In the intimacy of their studios, a place Thornton considers their private stages, she uncovers their personas, myths, triumphs, and tears in a clever narrative structured into three acts. In conversation tonight with Allison Agston, Thornton will unveil some of the scenes that make up this fascinating read about some of today's most public and perplexing creators of contemporary art. Artists in Three Acts is 33 Artists in Three Acts is author Sarah Thornton's follow-up to the international hit 7 Days in the Art World, named one of the best art books of the year by the New York Times and translated into 17 languages. She is a former writer for The Economist and is based in London, but she travels widely and lectures often at museums, universities, and literary festivals around the world. Moderating tonight's conversation with Sarah is Allison Agston, curator of public engagement at the Hammer Museum, where she directs an innovative new curatorial program focused on creating an exchange between visitors and the museum through works of art. Agston knows the art world well, having previously worked at LACMA, and prior to that, as a producer at CNN, where she regularly covered the arts. So please join me in welcoming Sarah Thornton and Allison Agston to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library.
Hi, guys. Sarah, so happy to be with you tonight. Something that was very interesting for me about reading this book is that in many respects, our practices are the same as a curator. I am out and about in the world talking with artists. Sometimes I'm in their homes. Oftentimes I'm in their studios. But I'm sure my approach is so different from yours as a trained sociologist. So if I really only had one question, it would be this one. I'm really curious to know about your methodology for creating this book.
Well, I never trained as a journalist. I did my PhD on dance clubs and raves, and it involved a lot of participant observation, as it's called, with British youth culture, nightlife. Ethnography is a combination of two research methods, participant observation and interviewing, and it's really important to have both. And often you're accessing nuanced things that are kind of so obvious to people that they're below consciousness. And so for my first book, Club Cultures, which was based on my PhD, I was looking at the dynamics of hipness and coolness. And this book, 33 Artists in Three Acts, is actually bears, in some ways, it's more similar to that book than 7 Days in the Art World, insofar as I'm basically trying to understand what is credibility, what is believability in a contemporary art world where there's no, there are no generally accepted standards for quality or excellence. You know, how do artists accrue a consensus of belief around their work? And how are they involved in generating that consensus? Because I think artists are often presented as kind of victims of the art world. And actually, I think when you start it kind of exploring it with them, that there's some agency there.
There are actually a couple of really great passages in the book that really get at this. Do you think we could, at this early stage in the talk,
sure,
maybe get to some of them, a couple of them?
Well, sure. One One thing I'm always interested in is at that moment when an artist feels confident declaring themselves an artist. Because just having a BA or an MFA degree is rarely enough. For example, Lori Simmons walked into kindergarten and announced that she was an artist. That's very rare. And of course, the chances that she would still be an artist at age 62 are very highly unlikely. So I'll just read this passage, actually, between Elm Green and Dragset, who describe themselves as each half an artist or a two-headed monster. And they can't even agree on whether to call themselves an artist or not. But one of the reasons I like reading it is because Dragset talks about that moment when he felt he could declare himself an artist. So Elm Green says, "I don't have the taste in my mouth or the smell in my nose of being an artist. I'm a cultural producer," says Elm Green with a semi-flamboyant wave. Dragset flicks his eyes to the sky, then looks to me for support. "I'm an artist. I wouldn't call myself anything else, just as I'm gay and I wouldn't call myself queer. I remember very well making the decision to accept myself as an artist. I had my 30th birthday in New York City, where we had a residency. Up until that point, I had felt embarrassed. Then I thought, fuck it. I can be an artist just as much as anyone else." Then Elm Green replies somewhat mischievously. He says, "These identity groups are so last century. You are a gay artist in the 20th century. I would also say that we're far too busy to be artists. We make artworks, do a theatrical performance, publish a book, design a t-shirt, create a show. We are like small mice avoiding being trapped or cornered. Our work is not about universal truths. All we do is tell small lies."
Anyway. This is an example of two artists, or one artist, depending on how you want to look at it, coming from totally different perspectives. But I imagine once you compiled your research and it's all together and you've got this book and you've spent so much time with it, that there must be some sort of through line, some characteristic that most of the artists in this book share.
Well, I mean, it's actually hard to find one thing they all share. The artists here are very much all professional artists, generally accepted by society as artists. I would call them insider artists in a certain kind of way, even though they're not all making a living from their work, and some of them have day jobs. The majority of them have reached certain levels of recognition. I've been asked, did I include outsider artists or folk artists? And that, for me, would be a completely different sociological world. And a lot of the values in those worlds are very different to the values of the insider art world. For example, the expectations of outsider art are very much, are often things that insider artists can't get away with. So the expectation that their work will be an authentic, self-expressive, free associational thing is something that is not de rigueur at all within the insider artist art world, which in part probably has to do with art school training nowadays.
So,
and the influence of Duchamp, because this is very much a Duchampian book.
It is. So the insider art world and the outsider art world, talking about that kind of takes me towards the end of the book and perhaps my favorite scene and my favorite act with Andrea Fraser. And you ask her what she thinks about Damien Hirst. And she says, essentially, well, I think he's an artist, but we're essentially in different art worlds. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that idea a little bit of different art worlds and what that could mean, particularly coming from Fraser.
I guess just to backtrack a little bit, the Artists are generally dealt with in isolation. They're the subject of monographs, they're subjected to profiles, and they're not compared and contrasted. And so one of the things I do is I structure the book around antagonistic foils. And in Act 1, the foils are Ai Weiwei and Jeff Koons, and in Act 3, they're Damien Hirst and Andrea Fraser. And for me, Fraser is very much the anti-Hirst in, for so many different reasons, not just because they inhabit different art worlds, which they certainly do. I mean, Hirst has probably moved through several art worlds in his lifetime, but he and now is very much in isolation, but he's known for his interventions in the market. And was famous for doing the Sotheby's sale, Beautiful Inside My Head Forever, which I was doing a lot of interviews with artists at the time and found that half the artists I interviewed thought that that auction where he took 200 works straight out of the studio onto the auction block was a conceptual event and a landmark event in an artist taking control of his market. And then the other half of the artists I interviewed said that he had ceased to be an artist at all. And of course, when anyone ceases to be an artist, that's really interesting for me. You know, when anyone ceases to be an artist in the eyes of others, that's a boundary line, an ideological boundary line. So it's difficult to talk about Andrea in her presence here, but I'm so glad she has graced it us with it.
Oh, I see her.
She teaches at UCLA. Hasn't made objects for sale in some time, is principally known for her performances and has even made artworks which take the form of articles with titles like Le 1% C'est Moi. And, Le 1% C'est Moi, you can see, is actually a critique of Damien Hirst's client base on one level, because it investigates the relationship between art collectors and the financial crisis, their involvement in the financial crisis. Whenever I set up an antagonistic pairing, I think it's important that they have also got something in common. And so with Ai Weiwei and Jeff Koons, they're about the same age. They're both work with ready-mades. They both use the media like nobody else. But one politicizes everything he touches, one depoliticizes everything he touches or attempts to. And part of the argument there is that there's no possibility of being apolitical. And I think with Andrea and Damien, they are both absolutely spectacular risk takers. They're absolute opposites, except they are both that. And they've both made landmark works that are kind of flags in the sand. I think if you think that the Sotheby's sale is an artwork, that's certainly on one far extreme. And then the work I would position on the other far end would be Andrea's Untitled. She always titles her work, I hope, I think, but chose the generic very specifically for a work in which she, and I have to watch my wording, but she solicited a collector to have sexual intercourse with her through her dealer, and the payment was part of a pre-production, for part of the production monies for the video. But there's clearly a prostitution metaphor at work. And it makes a very different comment about the art market.
Certainly. I want to talk about for a moment a question that you ask Damien Hirst, which the Damien Hirst interest for me continued to build throughout the book towards the end, really came to a crescendo. But I love the question you asked him. What is the difference between you and your myth? And he answers, your image is something you wear. It's not something that you are. So I'd actually like to ask you the question, but directed towards Koons and Ai Weiwei in specific, what the difference is between them and their myth, because when I read this book, they both played to type. Koons was physically and verbally hyper sheen, and Ai Weiwei was as activist and political as I imagine him to be. But I'm wondering if there's more to it than that.
Well, I actually disagree with Damien's quote here. You know, your image is something you wear. It is not something you are. I actually think that images can go a lot deeper than that. And where he goes with that quote is kind of into a terrain where he's almost talking about a midlife crisis, where he's ceased to believe in the Duchampian mode in which he's made most of his work up until now, and he's taken up the craft of painting in a manner, as he puts it, like Francis Bacon and actually Rembrandt. He does evoke Rembrandt. But I think that myths are embodied and enacted in ways that are very hard to, like, they're not like a mask that you can take off. And art needs myths to give it energy and power and mystique and greater oomph in all sorts of ways. But there are myths that no longer ring true and are offensive or bogus. And then myths that are kind of compelling and wonderful. Ai Weiwei, I think when you meet him over the course of the various scenes that you meet him in the book, I meet him on a high point at his Turbine Hall at Tate Modern, where he's, his sunflower seeds have just been installed, which I think is one of his greatest pieces. I book in to see him in Beijing, and he gets put in prison just before I arrive, so I have tea with his wife, Lu Qing, which I think is a kind of, you know, I was really pissed off, of course, flying all the way to Beijing and he was in prison. But as a narrative in the book, I think it's kind of poignant to actually talk things through with her. And
I actually wondered when I read it, could it have possibly been more interesting if you were interviewing him? For me, the answer was no.
Well,
it was a different insight on him than we would have had otherwise.
I hope so. And also I'm interested in others and I'm interested in relationships.
Yes.
And quite often there are scenes where a curator's in the room or a dealer's in the room with the artist or the artist's spouse. For me, I find, when I asked Ai Weiwei, what is an artist? He didn't have an immediate response. And he's someone who gives 3 interviews a day and is, you know, has a lot of answers for everything. But he started telling me the story of his father, who had trained as a painter, but then when he was put in prison and had no access to materials, became a poet. And that was with the Chiang Kai-shek government. Then later he fell afoul of the Maoist regime, was declared a rightist and exiled to the remote provinces of China. And he was declared an enemy of the state, or at least that's how Ai Weiwei saw him when he was growing up. So I then put it to Ai Weiwei. I said, well, I asked you this question. You gave me this anecdote. Does that mean an artist is the enemy of the state? And he paused and he said, well, an artist is an enemy of general sensibilities, which is a very romantic avant-garde notion of what an artist is. And actually, I think it's possible to enliven that myth in the context of a non-democratic country like China with no freedom of speech. Here, that is hard to live that myth credibly.
Right.
In a pluralistic society where you can shock as much as you like, and get away with a lot anyway. For me, I feel quite enthralled with Ai Weiwei's myth, I guess, at the end of the day. Jeff Koons doesn't answer that question directly, but he gives a lot of inadvertent answers in the course of his...
You really try to get it out.
Yeah, I insist on asking him the same question over and over again, and that adds for some amusing copy. But, you know, one of the things he says, which I think is absolutely true, and I wish I'd singled it out, and I wonder if I can find it. You know, he does liken artists to door-to-door salesmen.
And that's one of his constantly...
He brings it up over and over again. And the funny thing there is it's kind of like... And also, I have seen him, like, literally going door to door. Because when I was working for The Economist, they'd send me to Moscow, Kiev, Doha, Abu Dhabi. I've seen him there, actually. And not for his own shows, but pressing the flesh. It's interesting.
It's like a politician. So,
you know, obviously there's a part of him which is very much this door-to-door salesman character. But when he says it, you're like... Geez, that's so prosaic. You're like you're thinking that's way more than he is.
It is,
you know, and it is clear. It's way less than what he is, you know.
And we've heard that from him forever.
It's been one of his favorites for 30 years. Yeah. And one other thing he says inadvertently, and a lot of artists actually do. He says, if you're in the public eye for long enough, your inevitable fate is to be burned at the stake. Mm. So this kind of, you know, heretic saint metaphor strangely actually comes up a lot inadvertently, because of course no artist would liken themselves to a saint or a heretic directly, but artists will back into it.
Yeah, Andrea specifically said at the end that she doesn't want to be remembered as a saint.
That's true. That's true. And also, Andrea, towards the end of the book, is very articulate, talking about artists' fantasies. And one fantasy she identifies as artists' fantasies of omnipotence. Yes. And I think that ties in very much to these kind of inadvertent religious metaphors.
Well, since we're kind of on the subject of myth, when I was in the midst of reading this book, Tracy Emin gave an interview that circulated around the internet, and I bet many of you saw it because she said in a very quotable way something to the effect of course there are good artists who have children. They're called men. And then, as if I wasn't riled up enough, I'm reading Sarah's book.
She is actually my least favorite artist in the world. But anyway.
Okay. Now we know. I won't ask that question.
She's not in the book.
So, in the Marina Abramovich chapter, she says, you know What was that? Did I miss something?
Sorry, Abramovich says. Go ahead.
Sorry. Yep. Abramovich says, you know you're an artist when you have the urge to create, but this doesn't make you a great artist, she continues. Great artists result from the sacrifices that you make to your personal life. A woman, she claims, has to be like a man to be an artist. One of the reasons why there are fewer women artists than men is because women don't want to sacrifice their main function to reproduce, to have a family, and the everyday comforts of life.
I mean, it's a generational perspective and actually not uncommon amongst her age group. You know, other women in the book, Marina Ramage, Cindy Sherman, Beatriz Mejías, they don't have children. Laurie Simmons is the exception amongst the artists from that age group. And it's a big deal for them, and they talk about it a lot. And... I think for younger women, that's no longer the case, thank God. You know, one of the reasons I ended up having these three themes of politics, kinship, and craft is because they were the three themes that brought the term artist to the terrain of non-artist. So, you know, this is being part of the reaction to Ai Weiwei's work in America. You know, is he an artist or an activist? Is he an artist or a politician? You know, or is she an artist or is she a didactic illustrator? I mean, it is you know, one of those things that gets said with regard to artists and craftsmen. You know, are you an artist or a designer? Mm-hmm. You know, what more scathing thing can you say about an artist than that they're really a designer? And with regard to kinship, you know, historically, motherhood has threatened women's ability to be authentic, real artists. And, you know, artists nowadays, in a post-war Hollywood world where, you know, artifice reigns, are very quick to say, oh, there's no such thing as a real artist. Anyone can be an artist. But after 3 hours of interview, they'll back into some comment, oh, he's not a real artist. You know, not everyone can be an artist. It is a very tough, it's not even a job. It's an identity that requires authority, and you have to win that authority. And that has been historically harder for women. And because authenticity is being male defined. Abramovich actually says something else, because she distinguishes between her high and her low self. And her high self is her performing self. But I was very curious, why the term low and what's your low self? And after some prodding, she said, well, you know, you can be ashamed of your low self. And then she said, well, you know, I've always loved fashion. And in the 1970s, that made you a bad artist. And, you know, I don't think, you know, a love of football has ever had the same effect on a male artist's career.
Agreed. Maybe we can talk for a minute about the Katie Nolan section, because it's impossible to read the book and not see the note that Katie did not authorize her section, which makes me wonder about the relationship that you had with the rest of the artists mm-hmm. in writing the book. What was their mm-hmm. level of engagement with your process and their own representation?
Mm-hmm. Well, Katie wanted it to be known that she didn't approve of her scene. And this is something that you'll see whenever you see her work installed. Often when you see her work installed, there'll be a plaque on the wall saying that Katie Nolan did not approve. And so, you know, the fact-checking process for her scene had to be done through lawyers. And I had to calm my editor down. The good thing was writing for The Economist, you were like, really, you know, increases the size of your balls in these kind of things. And so anyway, my hands are a little bit tied about what I can say about Katie, but when you read the scene, you'll get it.
But what about the others?
The others. So I know Katie wasn't the only artist who didn't love her scene. I think there are two other artists in the book who weren't thrilled. I mean, Damien Hirst does hate me, so that's one. And I'd rather not say the other because I think she likes it now. Not because I made any changes, but I think she read it again when she wasn't hungover. or overtired. you know, I think I was met with a kind of jet-lagged kind of reaction.
I hope you'll whisper in my ear about that later.
I will never. I can't. But basically, no one had copy approval. And I don't think anyone even had quote approval, but I was very keen that everyone read their scenes. I wanted them to be accurate. I wanted them to recognize themselves. And I'm always keen to improve the quotes if there's some clarification. And often I'll try to do that in advance because one scene is rarely just based on one interview. I'll do follow-ups on the phone after I've done the transcription. So any, you know, it depends on how much access I had to different people. But often there'll be three interviews distilled into one so that all the quotes are punchy. Yes. So, I mean, Gabriel Orozco was one of the few artists who read the entire manuscript in draft form, and his line was, Well, we're all in our underwear, but at least some of us get to keep our socks on.
I was going to quote that if you didn't.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that I don't want to glorify people, but I don't want to humiliate people either. I have respect for everybody in the book. I don't agree with or like everything everybody's done, but, you know, they're of interest and they're of value. And there are certain artists, I think, who had to be in the book because they're bent, they're the people against whom others measure themselves. And that would be the case with Koons and Hirst. They come up, when you start talking to artists about what being an artist is today, Koons and Hirst come up in conversation, usually because the artist is distancing themselves from them, but not always. Katie Nolan, interestingly, loved Damien Hirst's Beautiful Inside My Head for its sale. She thought, she wished more artists had that much control over their market, because that's one of her obsessions.
She's fascinating, that Katie Nolan. So this question of what is an artist seems almost impossible to answer. And yet I was surprised throughout the book that so many of the artists actually had terms or phrases that they used to describe what an artist is. Could you maybe tell us about some of those phrases?
Yeah. I mean, if you, there was an easy answer to the question, you couldn't write a whole book about it. I mean, you know, and one of the things that's really interesting about being an artist is that you can ask that question over and over again and get such a broad range of answers, because it is a highly customizable role. And actually, the more it's customized, the more interesting it gets. The more individuated it is, the more interesting it gets. So, I mean, one thing that really fascinated me is that Wangeshi Mutu, who's a Kenyan-born, Brooklyn-based artist, in her mother tongue, there's no word for artist. The closest term is magician. And then she goes on to say, or someone who imbues objects with meaning and power. Which is a very good definition of a ready-made. And then we talk about the relationship between, contemporary art as a foreign import and how, you know, artists in Kenya basically spend quite a bit of time abroad participating in this other global cultural system. And then when I got around to asking, well, what kind of artist are you? She said that she saw herself as a tattletale, or someone who told the family secrets, which is an interestingly feminine take, and wonderful that she can go there. And actually one I identify with, because I kind of see my relationship to the art world as a bit of a tattletale. one I really love is Francis Elise. When I ask him what kind of artist he is, he says he's a midwife. He's just the guy on the side helping the work come out. And that's such a refreshing contrast to the abstract expressionist myths of creativity and virility and which you, Koons does evoke.
I have a vision of him with his arms outstretched at the ready.
Well, the funny thing was, there was a close ally of his, a Mexican curator called Cuauhtémoc Medina, there at the time, and he looked like kind of disturbed that Elise was describing herself as a midwife, until he realized that that was a Socratic theme, because Socrates was being a midwife to ideas. You know,
perfect.
That questioning process. Yeah. So, there are loads. I mean, I haven't counted up how many different, well, there are different explicit definitions, and then there are a lot of inadvertent innuendo.
I started to keep track, but then I eventually gave up. There were just too many witticisms for my little fingers to type. But there are plenty in there. Maybe we can return for a second to the particular setup of the book, the three acts, politics, kinship, and craft. For me, politics and craft were, like, that seemed obvious, but kinship was a bit of a surprise to me. Could you tell us a little bit about how you somehow came to those mm-hmm. three? Why mm-hmm. those three?
Well, I mean, I did 100 interviews before I decided on those themes, and they did seem to be the issues that defined artists, like I already mentioned. But also, I'm, interested in making contemporary art accessible to others, and I think those are really important things in life. Politics, ethics, human rights, freedom of speech, kinship, one's creative partnerships, muses, collaboration, working with others, love, craft in the broadest sense of the word, like all the skills required to be a contemporary artist today, but also just like executing things well is something that anyone can identify with. And so, I was trained on the kind of anthropological end of sociology, and those are kind of big anthropological themes. Kinship, in particular, if you went into an anthropological library, and maybe here, you'd probably find more books about kinship than any other theme.
Kinship was very satisfying to me. The Laurie Simmons, Carol Dunham relationship, and you happen to be interviewing them at the moment just before Lena Dunham becomes the Lena Dunham that we know. And I must say that I found her section to her scene to be, without a doubt, one of the smartest and most intelligent. And she was, as I'm sure, one of the younger artists in the book. She was really fiercely intelligent and seemed remarkably self-realized.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of my count, I don't count Lena as an artist, actually.
How many artists are there, by the way?
There are 29 artists in the book.
I heard you say something really clever about Gertrude Stein, and because I love Gertrude Stein, yeah. I hope you'll say it again.
Well, there are only 29 artists in the book, and my alibi there is that Gertrude Stein wrote a libretto called 4 Saints and 3 Acts, but there are actually 20 saints in the libretto. So
I feel if Gertrude can do
at one time there were going to be 33 artists and 3 acts, and then I ran out of space and time, and I didn't want overlap, and yes. So there was another question though. Yeah. So Tip and Laurie, Carol Dunham's nickname is Tip. He's a painter. Laurie Simmons, a photographer. Right from the beginning, I knew I wanted an artist couple in the book. I wanted to understand this, how one can command one's own self-belief as an artist and weather it in relationship to another, because so often it's the case that one artist lives in the shadow of her partner, usually, sometimes his partner. No, wait, his, yeah. Well,
and now they're really living in the shadow of their child.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why I brought Lena and her sister Grace into the picture, because they became relevant to the themes already discussed. It was actually quite hard for me to find an artist couple, partly because it was hard to find a couple with comparable levels of recognition, but also because I encountered a lot of strictures on my access. So there was actually an LA-based couple who I was interested in including, but they would never be interviewed together, only apart.
Why?
I never really got to the bottom of that, but I think it had to do with sensitivities around their practice and the cross-pollination of their practice and some discomfort there, but I don't know. I never, after, those initial separate interviews, I think I just kind of felt that this was beyond their comfort zone. And the kinship part of the book is the most intimate. It's where I've had probably the best access and the most number of interviews. And shall I read you a quick paragraph or two? Because Tip and Laurie had read 7 Days in the Art World and liked it and had friends who were in the book, and so they trusted me. They kind of knew where I was coming from and were... And Laurie's very open as well, and she kind of convinced Tip that he could be open too. They would argue with each other in front of me and actually talk about sensitive issues. So anyway, I'm interested in how artists declare themselves an artist and how they maintain self-belief through 40 years of practice, weathering storms, mid-career storms where they didn't maybe, you know, didn't get a single review for their show and things like that. And so when I asked them, I say about how they weather their insecurities and anxieties, Lori says, "When you are younger, you think about eradicating self-doubt. But as you age, you understand that it is part of the rhythm of being an artist. As I get older, I have developed my ability to examine self-doubt in private, to play around with it rather than push it away." Dunham, by contrast, experiences his uncertainties a strange mixture of self-loathing and megalomania. Humans set up hierarchies, and we are constantly judging. In the morning, you tell yourself you're a horrible artist. By the afternoon, you might feel like a god. By dinner, you're a lesser angel.
You know, as you were talking about Lori and Tip and having access to them and maybe not access to others and about that level of trust, it brought me back to a talk I actually gave this morning with some graduate students. And I've kind of come to the conclusion in my work that if it really all boils down to one thing, it's trust. It's trust with the public, it's trust with the artists that I work with, it's trust within my institution. And I'm wondering if maybe in closing, before we get to the Q&A, you could talk about the role trust played in the writing of this book.
It was huge. It was huge because I think the thing that differentiates the 130 artists from that I interviewed for the book and the ones who are in the book involved trust. It was, for the most part, Koons and Hurst accepted a collaborative process in which they really had to want to play ball with me and play my game. I mean, luckily with someone like Andrea, she was already playing that game in a superlative way.
There's a rapport in there somewhere that I can't put my finger on, but there's something... Something particularly feels harmonious there or something.
Well, very funnily, and I actually had forgotten it, I once wrote, I wrote a review of her MIT Press book, collection of writings, I think called Museum Highlights. And I titled the review, "The Artist is the Institution." And that was actually before 7 Days in the Art World even came out. And so I think that, you know, it may have been through Andrea's work that I started thinking about the problem of the artist and then also coming to it from my sociological background. One thing we have in common is we both have studied Pierre Bourdieu, a sociologist of culture. And yes.
Wow.
So trust was really important. I mean, the other thing that distinguishes the artists in the book is that, I mean, not all of them, but a lot of them are carving out intriguing roles for the artist and working with metaphors or, you know, exploring that theme in their work as well. Sometimes that's a reason for inclusion. I mean, I wanted to represent some of the diversity in the field between academic and entertainer and materialists and idealists and altruists and narcissists.
Ever fascinating. I suppose that many of you have questions, so this seems like it might be a good time to open it up.
One down here.
Hi, Sarah. You talked earlier about myth-making, and I was curious about how you dealt with that question in terms of the book actually being a platform for these artists to broadcast their own myths. Like, how much did you try to dig underneath the myths themselves, and how much were you willing to just sort of give them the stage and let them play?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are things that defy belief in the book. And I often let them lie and let the reader be the judge. I mean, not lie in the lying sense, but let them lay there. It could be lying, actually. You know, some people do say things that are seem disingenuous. I didn't leave... Basically, artists who are like that, and I did quite a few interviews like that, and they didn't make it into the book for the most part. I mean, the book is biased towards honest, articulate people, let's say. There are definitely moments where I don't believe what an artist is saying, and I think you know that. There's some interesting moments with Cindy Sherman, and I think it has to do with what she doesn't really love giving interviews. She refused to give me an interview initially. She was when I came up with the idea of the book for the book in the summer of 2009. She was really like in my top five lists I had to interview based on her work. It seemed relevant. But then, when I finally got to see her, which took some time, and it was only when she was under pressure to promote her show at MoMA New York. And she was thoughtful and generous, but there were certain territories that she just didn't want to go to around the work. For example, there were different artworks of hers, which I saw as representations of artists, which she did not see as representations of artists. But they kind of defied belief, because one of the works was based on a Caravaggio, you know, self-portrait as Bacchus, which is the general title it's known by, you know. And at that moment, either she's forgotten or she just doesn't want to go there. And she's saying, really? I didn't know it was a self-portrait. I was like, you took the time to meticulously reenact this work, you know. And actually, it had even been written about in previous catalogs and things like that. So, you know, she doesn't love giving interviews. And I'm grateful that she not only saw me once, but then saw me again when she was installing it at the same show at SF MoMA. And I'm really glad she's in the book. I think, especially because one of the things I'm interested in is artistic orthodoxies, and one of the orthodoxies in the universe of Cindy Sherman is that her the works are not self-portraits, and that's the opening line in the catalog essay, and it's the line her curator is kind of almost obligated to say, and then that kind of intentionalist fallacy potentially, gets amplified, you know, through discourse. And I was like, my feeling is, but, you know, what if the works are self-portraits? Let's think about it this way. This is kind of interesting, especially because I think Sherman has become all the more salient in a time of selfies. When she started doing this work, we didn't have cell phone cameras, and we weren't constantly documenting ourselves and taking our own pictures. And now it's almost creepy the degree to which we do that, you know. So yes, I think one of the things that differentiates me from an art critic is that, and my ethnographic training is to hold myself back for the most part. And so, you know, you do learn tidbits about me as you go through the book, but one of my interviewers in Canada a few weeks ago was saying, I was amazed, I got to page 182, and the only two things I knew about Sarah Thornton was that she had cats and she had a daughter called Cora. You know, you do, I come into a little bit more in my kind of antagonistic relationship with Hearst, but that's at the very end of the book.
I thought that was actually handled with extraordinary grace and a certain journalistic remove. I didn't sense the Hearst tension.
Really?
Until, I think, probably later than I should have, frankly. Carefully, perhaps. But
I try very hard to be fair and fair-minded.
I thought that you were. But I know you attribute that to your training as a sociologist, but I couldn't help read it and think of you as a journalist also.
Well, yeah, I am a journalist. I mean, what I aspire to is researching like a well-funded academic and writing like a reporter.
Nice.
So,
hi. This is not as much a question, but something to share, an experience to share that's somewhat related to the midwife metaphor as well. About a year or so, I had the pleasure, fortune, to be invited to a small dinner party with the art critic Christine McKenna. When she was introduced to me and my husband, she naturally said, oh, are you artists? And we both took that question like a hot potato and passed it back and forth, and then I stumbled, and I said, well, I went to an art school, and she cut me off and said, being an artist is like being pregnant. You can't be a little bit pregnant.
Yes, that's an, that is. I love that actually because it's it feels like a feminist metaphor. Over here, there are a couple. Yeah.
In the course of researching this book, I'm under the impression that you were looking for artists that had interesting myths or personas or identities that they could share with you and with the readers of your book. And I'm wondering, and in some of the artists that you've worked with in the book are very well known and others less so. I'm wondering if you encountered artists that might have been well known, but in fact you discovered that they didn't have a certain kind of conception of themselves that might be thought of as mythological, and therefore were just kind of, in a way, not, well, maybe ordinary people. I don't think most people really think of themselves in terms of a persona, a public image. I think they usually just think of themselves as I am who I am, who I am. Did you discover artists at the upper end of the art world that had more that type of approach?
Absolutely. And actually, I would say the vast majority of the artists in the book do not feel like they have a persona and feel alienated from the term persona. And I don't see the book as being about persona so much as just about the public life of people. Myths don't have to be big, grand narratives in a way. They can just be the stories we tell ourselves while we do our job that make it more interesting, you know? And just going back, the youth of this gentleman who asked me that first question, there are basically no emergent artists in the book. One of the things having done my PhD on youth culture, I realized fairly early on that I couldn't do justice to emergent artists as well as have the global sweep I was interested in, because it just brought in another variable which made it too hard to handle. And so the artists in the book really, for the most part, have at least 20 years experience being an artist. And I found that their answers to my questions, to the kinds of questions I was asking, were deeper and richer and more interesting. So.
Hi. So you've, of course, been an observer of the art world, but have you begun to participate, be it collecting or more studio visits rather than interviews? And if so, which artists interest you today?
I do have interesting things on my wall, but I would never call myself a collector, and I'm pretty low budget because I am a writer. My girlfriend owns a gallery in San Francisco, and so I end up participating through her, but never in my own name, so to speak. And so writing for The Economist actually helped me keep my distance in a way, because it's a magazine for general readers, and I could assume absolutely no art knowledge whatsoever when I was writing. Sometimes frustratingly so, sometimes not. I think it's kind of a good discipline. I think that I definitely became much more of an insider. There's no doubt about it. I walk around the art fairs and I know a load of people, and I find that fun. It's become my social milieu, if not my dominant social milieu. I think that it's nice to try to cling on to that sense of estrangement that, like, gives ethnographers a high, so to speak. And so I do think that, you know, the distinctive flavor of artists' work and studios and things like that can sometimes give you that feeling of being in another culture, which is very much their culture. Their universe. Does that answer your question?
Yes, but which artist do you like?
Say that again. Which artist do I like? Well, I thank God every day I'm not an art critic, and that liking or disliking these things is really not the most interesting question to ask. And actually, perhaps hating it is way more important. Which is the more important artwork?
Next question.
Yeah.
I was intrigued to hear you mention Pierre Bourdieu, and I wanted to get your thoughts on in what ways class and social status kind of have that adversarial relationship, both within the community of artists as they advance their careers and as well in their relationship to collectors and art as a signifier in the larger social context.
Class is a really important issue, and one that I'm obsessed with, and actually I find it very difficult to give any broad overarching generalizations about it, because it's, especially in American culture, I find very hard to read. I think there are very big class differences in the origins of artists in different countries, so that historically artists have come much more from the working class in the UK, and it's partly because of a art school system which was public, and a certain kind of middle class snobbery about art schools. My sense in America, just partly because there are statistics that show that artists are the most downwardly mobile profession in America, suggests that perhaps artists are coming from like the upper middle classes or the middle classes and then descending into income levels that take them way lower than that. You know, the vast majority of artists nowadays do go to art school of some kinds, and that can cost quite a, you know, and also the job spectrum at the end of it is so uncertain that it's not usually a working class choice to be able to spend on an education that's not going to take you somewhere directly. Class comes up in various parts of the book. In the kinship section, it comes up in relation to William Paujita and Jennifer Dalton. William Paujita actually teaches high school in Brooklyn, and Jennifer has a day job, kind of doing clerical work that doesn't interfere with her mind space to do her work. They still both have kind of like primary identities as artists. He's an art teacher. And they've collaborate together. They have artistic identities on their own, and then they also collaborate together. And one of the things they did was a few weeks long series of seminars called Hashtag Class. And I don't know if you know Ben Davis's book, which is about class and art. And I'm just trying to, is it Martin Luther, the original. I think it's called 9.5 Theses About Art and Class. Anyway, and you know, Ben Davis talks, I think, quite persuasively about how so much antagonism towards the art market is actually in part a class antagonism. Because, the objection sometime, well, there's lots of objections to be made, but the objection is not so much that art is commodified and then is bought and sold, but that the disparity between the high end and the low end, or the high end and of the art world is so extreme. It's, you know, from a sociological point of view, there are few social worlds that have such hierarchical extremes in them. And I actually can't think of one.
You said something really interesting to me about some signifiers of class that crop up in the book. Like, for example, somebody's wearing Margiela shoes, somebody's eating ceviche or some such raw food like that. And you said that the art world totally doesn't get that, but that for sociologists, that's essential to writing this kind of a book.
Well, I mean, all of that empirical information, there are class markers and income markers and nationality markers in all of that empirical detail. And so, I have been met with some, a curator who says, like, why should I care what kind of shoes he's wearing? Well, if you're a sociologist, actually, it's very interesting, and actually, brands are part of the way we create social selves. So the difference between Converse All-Stars and Margiela is significant. Oh, one right here.
Hi. I'm going to ruin her name, but you didn't speak about, because I don't know how to pronounce it.
The Brazilian?
No, Yayoi Kusama.
The Japanese Yayoi Kusama.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love her work tremendously. And I just wanted to know if you could speak about her, because I haven't read the book yet. Mm-hmm. And if there were anything that was poignant or... she's interesting in and of herself and her, where she lives and how she copes.
Absolutely. Yayoi Kusama is the oldest artist in the book. I was lucky enough to spend 2 days with her with a tape recorder in her studio in Tokyo. And then I also did a supplementary interview with her in London when she was there for her Tate Modern opening. She lives in an asylum across from the street from her studio, and she has done since the mid-70s. And she's lost her English. So she lived in New York for many years and spoke English, but is kind of gone. So I relied on interpretation. Thankfully, I also had a tape recorder on the go, because the gap between the interpretation and the actual translation was huge, especially in a very polite society like Japan, where things that she was saying were perhaps felt to be rude. Like, she does have a big ego, and she talks about, in a quite poetic, forceful way. And I just couldn't, that was not captured at all in the room. So I'd spent 2 days there kind of not certain what had happened. And then, thank God, I got the transcript from an independent person. There were so many fascinating things about that trip. One of the things that she does is that she performs the act of painting while I'm there for the Asia Pacific Acquisitions Committee from the Tate, who are making a visit with Francis Morris, the chief curator of Tate Modern. And Francis Morris, I want to find it actually, because I hate to bastardize it, but she is giving a kind of voiceover commentary to the act of painting. And as if they were at the 18th hole and it was a very tight match. and it just it cracks me up. Let's see, here we go. I think I can find it. I can read, I don't know where to start because I'd have to go carefully. But basically, they've prepared a canvas for her, which is covered in silver paint. And interestingly, she paints like an outsider artist. Now, her current paintings look like outsider art. There are a lot of conventions and tropes to that repetitive, figurative, patterning kind of work. And anyway, they wheel her up. She sits down. She starts painting. Yeah, and Frances Morris says, whispers, it's almost like automatic drawing. There is no hesitation, and then kind of continues on. Kusama was not someone who I could really get direct answers from, but I was keen to have her in the book, partly because I have been a very big fan of her work. The book is both curated and cast in a way, so the curating relates to the work that the artists are doing, and the casting relates to their willingness to interact with me and think about these things with me. And I tell an anecdote in the introduction about how, you know, one of my favorite artists, when I asked him what is art, he said, sorry, when I asked him what is an artist, he says, an artist makes art, you know, end of conversation. And so, you know, and I actually felt like his discourse was incredibly dusty and that he'd come up with something that worked for him in the 1970s and early 80s and stuck with it, and that it didn't really ring true anymore. And I still like his work, but I don't like it as much as I did. You know, got to be honest.
Well, Sarah, thank you. It was really illuminating.
Thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.